Support for WPR comes from Des Moines Art Center, presenting Father of Mexican Photography, Manuel Alvarez Bravo, Collaborations, on view through January 18th. Details are at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention to begin the show by talking with you about phonology with Stan Temple. Back with us once again, he's a professor emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, studies how the change in seasons affect reproduction cycles for plants and animals. And as we talk with Stan, I hope you will join in. Give us a call. What about the cycles in nature around you? Have you paid attention to the birds or other wildlife to track their behavior over the course of a year? Have you heard of phenology before? You can join in with your questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Stan Temple, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Yeah, it's good, Larry. And I suppose your regular listeners certainly know about phenology. We've been doing this annual show for over 10 years.
It's been great. And every year I look forward to the latest Wisconsin phenology calendar. What are some of the phenological events that happen, maybe that are happening right now here in our state?
Yeah, most people, when they think of phenology, they often focus on the sort of welcome events of spring. Migratory birds are arriving, plants are blooming, and somehow fall becomes the sort of month in which things are disappearing, and people aren't quite as enthusiastic, perhaps, about monitoring what's going on. But there are some really interesting things happening during fall, during the months of September, October, and November, meteorological fall. If you're into plants, one of the last blooming plants in Wisconsin is blooming right now. If you're lucky enough to have a witch hazel shrub in your neighborhood, you've probably seen the bright, very unusual yellow flowers. It is one of the very last flowers to bloom in Wisconsin. And, of course, it's pretty hard to ignore the falling of leaves, but it's perhaps even more difficult to ignore the falling of acorns if you have an oak tree in your neighborhood, or, as I do, have an oak tree overarching your house. Those acorns sound like a major hailstorm coming down. But there's an interesting thing happening. White oaks and red oaks and black oaks are all dropping their acorns, but something very different happens after those acorns have fallen. White oak acorns germinate right away. So they're germinating in the fall, whereas black oaks and red oaks don't germinate till the following spring. That was always kind of a puzzle. And I think people have finally thought that it probably has something to do with passenger pigeons.
Oh.
When passenger pigeons were around, they're extinct now, but when they were around, they were incredibly efficient predators on acorns. And by having their acorns germinate quickly, almost as soon as they drop, white oaks have sort of protected their acorns against being gobbled up by passenger pigeons. But in any event, you know, it's something that often gets overlooked. If you're into insects, you know, during the fall is when the insect world goes silent. They reach that critical temperature when the average temperature drops into the 50s, when their metabolism no longer accommodates activity, like crickets perhaps being the most notable, and they stop making sound. So suddenly the insect world goes silent. There's all kinds of folklore about things in the fall, the woolly bear caterpillar. That one just is bizarre, that people somewhere along the line got the idea that the width of the brown bands on these caterpillars they're rather endearing little caterpillars.
Yeah, and they are.
And they're very active during fall as they're trying to find a place to spend the winter. But the width of the stripe has absolutely nothing to do with the severity of winter. It has to do with how many molts the caterpillar has gone through in its life. And the width gets wider and wider each time. Birds, of course, most of our migratory birds have left. But a whole host of migratory birds are arriving to spend the winter with us. And it all happens during this three-month period. So most people, even in town, are aware that, you know, the juncos arrived and the white-throated sparrows. And if you're lucky, this year in particular, there are a lot of really impressive northern finches, like evening grosbeaks, that are showing up in Wisconsin to spend the winter with us, where most of our breeding birds have headed to the tropics or to warmer climes. Mammals, of course, are entering hibernation.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are sort of dropping out of the picture. You've probably seen squirrels and chipmunks going crazy collecting nuts during the fall. And for the chipmunks, they're going to hibernate. They're going to go dormant. But they've been stashing all those nuts away because they wake up during the winter and take advantage of their little larder of nuts to feed on, to keep them going over the long winter. So a lot going on.
A lot going on, and a lot of that kind of appears in the phenology calendar, which I love, by the way. I love that calendar. I have it right behind on the wall right behind my chair and set low so that I can just turn around and take a look at what's going on for a particular day.
Yeah, it's become a very popular calendar in Wisconsin. It gives you an opportunity to anticipate when almost 200 different natural events are going to happen during the year. And it's also an educational calendar in that every year I pick a theme for the calendar and write an essay that introduces the calendar to talk about whatever the theme might be. The theme for this year, for 2025, was focused on how plants and animals stay within their temperature comfort range, their thermal niche. Next year, for 2026, the theme is a reflection back on Nina Leopold Bradley's contributions to phenology and to the phenology calendar. But then, as you know, every month there's also a little sidebar to the calendar.
Which I love.
That talks about some event that's happening during the year and in that month and explores it in a little more depth.
It's and don't forget the photography.
Yeah, the amazing what the nature photographers of Wisconsin are able to come up with. I don't think we've ever had a request that we've sent out for an image that hasn't just had a deluge of offerings from nature photographers. And sometimes we come up with some pretty specific, pretty odd images that we're looking for, and it appears that nothing is sacred anymore. These photographers have captured just about every possible event in nature.
They're always a pleasant surprise, and I enjoy turning that over every month and seeing what the next picture holds. You mentioned Nina Leopold Bradley, and of course Aldo Leopold. We talk a lot about Aldo, but we don't spend as much time as we should be probably on Nina Leopold Bradley.
Yeah, I think that's right, and why we're sort of celebrating her contributions with the 2026 calendar. Nina was the middle child of Aldo and Estella Leopold. She was born in New Mexico when the family was there, Aldo working in the Forest Service, but she grew up, a lot of her maturation was here in Wisconsin. And like all of her siblings, Nina was exposed to a father who was a great naturalist and encouraged all of his children to be in touch with nature. And one of the ways that he did that was through keeping phenological records. And we know that the five siblings, once Aldo Leopold became a professor at the university and acquired the Shack property up in on the banks of the Wisconsin River near Baraboo, that the family went up there on weekends, and one of the many sort of outdoor activities that they participated in was keeping phenological records. And the kids really competed with one another to see who could find the first blooming of a pasque flower or the first arrival of a bluebird or whatever the event might be. And Aldo became something of a folk hero in the field of phenology because his records from the 30s and 40s, he died in 1948, they are a marker for how the lives of plants and animals have subsequently responded to climate change. And we can monitor how different things are today than they were back in Aldo's time. Well, Nina, sort of remembering perhaps the joy of keeping phenological records with her family, when she moved back to Wisconsin in 1976, she built her retirement home just down the road from the family shack and resumed keeping phenological records. And like her father, she was a curious naturalist, and after a time noted that the dates on which she was recording some of these events had shifted dramatically to much earlier times. And eventually, her observations led her to want to share that information with the scientific world that during the 1970s was just starting to really come to grips with climate change science. And Nina figured that, well, her phenological records were clearly a good indicator of how plants and animals have been shifting, adapting to climate change. And she published in 1999 a really important paper, one of the very first papers that used historical phenological records, in her case from her father, to document how plants and animals were responding. So Nina, 1976, she started keeping these records. She kept those records literally almost till the day she died in 2011 at age 93. It was just part of her daily routine. And it is that way for many people, that once you become tuned in to everything that's happening in the natural world around you, you almost subconsciously end up keeping track of things and anticipating when favorite events are going to happen during the year. So Nina was a remarkable person, and we sort of celebrate her in the calendar this year, and particularly looking at her data from 1976 to 2011, which for anyone who's paid attention to what's happening with the climate, it was during the 1970s that climate change really accelerated. It had been increasing gradually through the early 20th century, but by the 1970s, it took off. People will remember the famous or infamous hockey stick graph that showed this tremendous acceleration. And Nina was right there at the right time and in the right place, that she was able to compare her records with her father's records from the same place. And for not just for cultivated plants or domestic animals, but for hundreds of natural native species of plants and animals. So it's really a treasure trove and a credit to her that she kept this going.
Stan Temple, our guest today, senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation and emeritus professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, talking with him about phenology and the phenology calendar that's coming out for 2026. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. At 11:45 today, we'll talk with the author of a new field guide, Birds of the Great Lakes. And at 12:30, we'll talk about the birds at Horicon Marsh and how you can get involved maybe with a bird watching group there. Right now, Stan Temple with us talking phenology and the phenology calendar for 2026 from the Aldo Leopold Foundation, something that he puts together, kind of a labor of love, I think we could say.
It is, Larry. And, you know, when I joined the faculty here in 1976, the same year that Nina returned to Wisconsin, she was one of the first non-academic individuals that I met. And it didn't take us long to realize that we were both sort of passionate about keeping phenological records. So over the years, you know, our shared interest in phenology, mine primarily in birds and animals, kept a lively conversation going between us.
Mia in Beaver Dam has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mia.
Hi. My question is, if you've never really practiced phenology before, how can you get started in an easy way, either just in your backyard or around your town?
Well, it's easy today because there are several organizations, citizen science organizations, that actually recruit people to participate in their programs. So now, if you're interested in observing events in your neighborhood, you are invited to share your observations. The big one is eBird, for bird watchers sharing their observations of birds. If you're into plants, there's the National Phenology Network. And both of them have these easy apps that allow you to upload your observations directly from your smartphone or computer. So you don't even need to remember things. You can almost do it instantly. Just when you see something, upload it. The value of that, of course, is that now with climate change, phenological records have become increasingly important. And scientists rely on the volume of data that now comes from citizen scientists to help them understand the patterns. And both eBird and the National Phenology Network, as well as, of course, our phenology calendar from the Aldo Leopold Foundation, are great resources to help you sort of get into the practice of keeping records.
Yeah, and explain what that calendar is all. I mean, we've talked about some of it, but, you know, somebody like Mia could make good use, I think, of the calendar.
Yeah, the main thing for people like Mia would be that looking at the calendar day by day, we sort of alert you to what you should be aware of in the natural world that might be happening shortly after the date at which we've announced it. We have to update the calendar regularly because things are happening earlier and earlier each year, but it gives you a way of anticipating when things are going to happen. And, of course, maybe pique your curiosity to actually try to find some of the things that maybe you weren't aware of in the neighborhood that might be happening.
We should, and how can Mia or anybody else get a copy of the calendar?
Yeah, the very popular phenology calendar now. It's really grown in popularity, but it's available from the Aldo Leopold Foundation. You can simply go to aldoleopold.org and order it from the bookstore. It's $18.95, which covers the postage. Great gift for Christmas, but it's a very popular calendar, and the popularity seems to grow every year as more and more people discover it and how much fun it is to actually keep track of things.
Mia, does that help?
Yeah, definitely, and I'm really excited to purchase my calendar. I usually get one every year, so thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Question or comment, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. You know, I looked this morning at my own calendar, and on the sidebar you had a note that for the month of November, that this year's calendar from 1976 to 2023, the average temperature at the shack, at Leopold Shack, increased by 1 degree per decade. So by 2050, the climate of Sauk County, where the shack is, might be found as far north as Marathon County, and that's about 130 miles north of Sauk County.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable when you sort of explain how climate change is affecting things, that plants and animals are shifting their geographic distribution to further and further cooler northern or higher elevations. So if you're, for example, in the western states, you've seen things sort of going up the side of the mountain as they progressively try to seek out cooler and cooler places. Here in Wisconsin, it's basically a movement northward. And for some organisms, you know, moving 130 miles is no sweat. If you're a bird, even a mammal, moving that distance, you know, is pretty easy. But if you're a small amphibian or reptile or certainly a plant, moving 130 miles, even in 25 years, is kind of a big challenge. And it means that many plants and animals just aren't going to be able to keep pace and continue to find places where the temperature is ideal for them. When, as the calendar last year, this year said, when they're in their thermal niche, when they're comfortable. We all know what that is for our house because we have a thermostat, but, you know, plants and animals have to make their own adjustments.
You know, and I'm thinking about the use of the calendar, how you use the calendar depending on where you're located. And if you're far north, you can still use this calendar, even though it's kind of based on what happens at the shack.
Yeah, and you know, it's fortunate that there is a sort of a rule of thumb that lets you do a rough calculation. A fellow named Andrew Hopkins was an entomologist who worked in a college of agriculture and came up with a rough equation that allows you to predict how phenology is going to change with latitude and longitude. And in the calendar, we give you that little equation that might let you adapt what we're showing you on the calendar, which is based on South Central Wisconsin, to other places. It's a rule of thumb. It's not 100% accurate, but it gives you an idea of how many days, or in some cases even weeks, things might be earlier or later than they are in South Central Wisconsin.
And once you figure it out, it's pretty easy.
Yeah.
You can do the math pretty darn quick.
Yep. Yep.
After that. After you read how to do that.
You know, it's amazing. You know, that's one little rule having to do with phenology. And there are others as well that people may or may not be aware of. I mentioned earlier that during fall is when insect sounds stop. And some people may be aware that there is a bit of, we'll call it scientific folklore, that if you listen to crickets chirping, if you count the number of chirps in 15 seconds and add 40, it is approximately the temperature outside.
Now, how accurate is that?
That is pretty accurate. That's a lot better than woolly bear caterpillars or groundhogs in reflecting what's actually happening out there. But if you do the math, you realize that by October and November, our average temperature is getting low enough that that equation goes to zero and doesn't really work anymore.
Somebody called and wonders if you could give the phone number for those who want to order a calendar but maybe are not on the internet. So,
yeah, I can. I don't have it memorized, but I will look quickly here. And, you're welcome to call, and they will take your order as well as you can do it, of course, most easily online, but the Alto Leopold Foundation number is 608-355-0279.
So let me make sure I've got this right. 608-355-0279.
Correct. And they will be happy to take your order.
Okay. There you go. Well, the month of December, of course, that's coming up not too darn long from now. There's a couple of things. Maybe we talk about what's going to happen in the coming months of December, but also it's the anniversary month of two important acts, the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act.
Yep.
Those acts had a huge effect on the field of conservation.
No, absolutely. They are all a reflection of the things that were happening during what is often nicknamed the environmental decade from the 1960s into the 1970s. Almost all of our sort of bedrock environmental and conservation legislation and policy was established. And for those who keep track of things, environmentalists and conservationists had better not get too complacent about some of these things, because they are very much under threat today. The Endangered Species Act is an endangered piece of legislation in many ways. It was a remarkable period of time for a totally nonpartisan consensus that we needed to take care of our environment. And tragically, over the decades, you know, the environment and conservation has become a divisive issue rather than a consensus.
Yeah. So what about the month of December? What's going on in the month of December?
Well, in terms of things that change, it used to be that sandhill cranes headed south in December. And now... The big congregation of sandhill cranes on the Wisconsin River, right behind Aldo Leopold's shack, they're sticking around well into January. And we've got a little bit of a in-house betting going on about whether this will be the winter when the cranes simply don't leave and stay in Wisconsin all year round, because winters are becoming milder and, of course, coming later and ending sooner. Next weekend, we're celebrating the Sandhill Cranes with the Great Midwest Crane Fest. So on the coming weekend, the International Crane Foundation and the Aldo Leopold Foundation will be hosting what, given that the weather is going to be remarkably warm after the cold snap we've just had, we're anticipating thousands of people are going to descend on the Leopold Foundation and the International Crane Foundation to celebrate the recovery of sandhill cranes and witness the large numbers of birds that are congregating there.
So people will be, what all is going to happen at that? Well, I mean, we've talked about it, but it's been a few weeks since I visited about it.
Yeah, well, it's 2 days at both foundations that are just a couple of miles apart. Have nonstop activities. There are lectures going on, there are exhibits, there are tours going on. I'm giving a bunch of talks at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. And of course, the highlight of the weekend is getting to see the cranes. So for those who were fortunate enough to put in their reservation early, they can go out to the river with me and enjoy the spectacle of thousands of cranes staging for their migration.
Yeah, it's an amazing amazing weekend coming up, and the weather's going to be pretty decent, I think, for the most part. Certainly on Saturday.
Yeah,
for sure. Well, in January, a couple of birds like northern cardinals and black-capped chickadees begin their songs.
Yeah, this it's during the changing seasons. You know, the two things that most people are aware of in the physical environment is day length changes, that it gets shorter after the summer solstice, and then, you know, gets longer in the spring. They'll also note that accompanying that is a change in temperature. And day length and temperature are two of the principal drivers of phenology, of when these events are happening. Plants and animals cue into temperature and day length to sort of trigger these seasonal events. And in January, days are getting longer, slightly, but it's enough to trigger the behavior of some of our resident birds, like chickadees and northern cardinals. So they get psychologically primed to start doing territorial behavior to have a nesting territory later in the spring. But that urge is suppressed by temperature. So if it's cold out, nobody's going to sing. But if you have a warm, sunny day, which, you know, Wisconsinites always look forward to the January thaw, these birds will suddenly burst into territorial song because the temperature allowed that behavior to be released. And now, of course, you know, we list that the chickadees begin their territorial song on January 1st. I mean, they've been moving, you know, they're weeks ahead of when Aldo would have recorded this. And, you know, it's like, well, it's maybe no longer going to be an event for January. It may end up being an event for December.
It's amazing to me that the change has gotten, and that's I guess the fun about having a calendar, or getting yourself more attuned to the to those events.
And honestly, I mean, there's a subversive reason for promoting phenology and having the phenology calendar, and that was something that Aldo Leopold was well aware of, that getting people hooked on monitoring and tracking seasonal events is a great way to get them in touch with the environment around them, to get, it's often termed, a sense of place, to know what's happening, you know, in the natural world around you. And when he was a professor at the University of Wisconsin, Aldo Leopold actually required his graduate students to keep phenological records. And he did that very openly, saying, you know, if I don't let you or make you do this, you're going to pay attention to the animal that you're studying or the immediate things that are happening on your study area, and you'll lose touch with the bigger ecosystem around you. So, you know, subversively, we're thinking that this phenology calendar is a good way to let people get a sense of place and sort of get in touch with the natural world around them.
I was thinking about bears.
Mm.
Bears, you know, you might think they're sleeping during the winter months, but on January 5th, I think, black bear sows give birth to cubs in their dens, or that's when it starts.
Yeah. Yeah, we often think of, you know, birthing of young animals happening later in the spring. But, yeah, for bears, it happens pretty much in the dead of winter. And, of course, those young cubs stay with their mother in the den and don't emerge until much later in the spring. And bears, you know, we often think of bears as hibernating, and you know, they're not going into a deep sleep that's going to last all winter the way, say, a woodchuck, a groundhog might. Obviously, if they're giving birth and, you know, taking care of the cubs in the den, you know, they are dormant, certainly, but still active metabolically.
And those dens are really interesting to me because they can be just not really what you might think of as a den.
Yeah, often it doesn't look like, you know, a place where we might want to hole up during the winter, but it gives them enough shelter. And the shelter is important, to have something over your head, which anybody who does winter camping knows how important that is, so that you're not radiating a lot of heat to the sky. But yeah, when you think about, you know, when things sort of start waking up, there are a lot of other animals that start their territorial behavior or start their mating behavior very early in the year. And probably the one that many people will hear about are great horned owls.
Yeah.
who are setting up their territories very early. In fact, they're already starting to be very active and hooting at night. There's something going on now in the fall that generally is called the fall shuffle. It's when young birds that were raised the previous summer are moving around the landscape trying to find a place that they can settle, and in the process trespassing on on other territories, and they get the boot. And at least if you're an owl, the way you give the boot is to hoot loudly and, you know, drive these young animals out of your territory. But yeah, owls are already starting their mating season.
And there's a reason for the, you know, kicking them out. I mean, they need to go to new territory.
Sure, sure. And the parents need to get busy getting ready for the next brood.
Well, you know what? We've been talking about a whole range of things here, and it just reminds me again that part of the fun of having this phenology calendar is you start thinking about those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just plain fun once you get hooked. And as I said, you know, we're celebrating Nina Leopold Bradley in next year's calendar. And for Nina, throughout her life, you know, keeping phenological records was just plain fun. As her father described it, it was the pleasure of the search. But once you get past that introduction where it's fun to do, then, you know, if you're curious, you start to ask questions. And as Nina did, try to find, as her father described it, find order and meaning in what you've observed. So it's a process, and we hope more people will be encouraged to do that by buying the calendar.
And how do we get the calendar?
You can order it from the Aldo Leopold Foundation at aldoleopold.org, pretty simple, and order it from the bookstore, $18.95, which includes postage.
And I wrote that phone number down, too. If you do not have access to, or if you just want to call, you can call it 608-355-0279. 608-355-0279. Stan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Look forward to it next year.
We'll look forward to having you back. Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and he's the guy that kind of comes up with the new calendar every year, and it's one you're going to really enjoy. I think you'll also enjoy hearing about a new book. It's called Birds of the Great Lakes, and we'll talk with the author next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. I've got a little quote for you. It says, "Pay attention and the birds will reveal themselves to you." That's what our next guest, Grandpa, always said about bird watching. And we're talking about the book with the author, Birds of the Great Lakes, How They Look and Sound, Where to Find Them, and How to Protect Them. And our guest, Dexter Patterson, joins us. He's an educator, a multimedia professional, co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. And as we talk with Dexter, I hope you'll join in. Give us a question. What questions do you have about our birds of the Great Lakes, our Wisconsin birds, and other birds as well? You'll have some answers for you. Maybe you want to know about habitat or bird behavior. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Dexter, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. It's good to see you.
Good to see you. Dexter and I go back a ways, I should say. He's now teaching a course that I used to teach before I retired, and from what I've been told, doing a magnificent job. So it's great. And it wasn't about birds. We didn't have the course wasn't about birds. Dexter has written this book and has been really involved pretty much your whole life, Dexter?
Yeah, I always tell people I always liked birds. Even when I was a kid, I just didn't give them the attention they deserved. I'd be like, red bird, blue bird, yellow bird, you know? I'd be watching them, but I didn't know what I was looking at. I just liked them.
So your book, Birds of the Great Lakes, what I really finding it interesting, but you tell us what people can learn from the book.
You know, so I tell people it's small but mighty, so it's a very compact book, but it has over 150 different bird species in it from 40 different bird families. The little book has over 360 pages, Larry, so there's a lot in it, but I made it small for a reason. I wanted it to be easy for people to throw it in their pocket, in their hoodie, have it with them at all times as a resource. But you can learn a lot about, you know, I tell people it's not this exhaustive list of birds that come through the Great Lakes region. It's more meant to make you curious, to start to pay attention, like my grandpa would say. So it's, I like to call it a window to wonder, where you open it up and then he's like, wow, I didn't know that was here. Wow, I didn't know that was here. Wow, I didn't know that was here. So ultimately getting you to pay attention. Yes, you'll probably see these birds that I have featured in the book. It was really hard, by the way, to pick what I wanted to put in here. but you'll probably see way more. And so that is the key, is I really wanted to create something that was accessible, that was easy to use, that you could have with you all time, and to get you curious and paying attention about the birds that are around us.
Well, the book, the photography in the book is fantastic.
Thank you.
And you took many of the photos of the birds in the book.
Yeah, I took most of them. I think I crowdsourced just a handful where I didn't like the photo I had. Maybe it was too far away. Couldn't see enough of the bird. I wanted to really make sure that people could see each bird, but the vast majority, 96, 97% of the photos are mine.
And they're really, really good. How long did it take you to put this all together?
I would say the good thing about the photos part of it is, I mean, I've been taking photos of birds for a long time.
Yeah.
So I had a nice library, and then there were, you know, some where I say, well, I probably should get a better shot of this one. So there were a few where I would go out and try to get better photos. But overall, putting the book together took me about 15 months to write it and put it together, and about 2 years for us to kind of complete the process.
You know, we were just talking with Stan Temple about phenology, of course, the study of the seasons. What are the birds doing now that fall is turning to winter?
You know, we have those late fall migrants coming through. It was pretty cool. I was at Horicon Marsh over the weekend for one of my book tour events. And, you know, I saw my first American tree sparrow of the late fall. So I was like, yay, they're back. I saw a bunch of dark-eyed juncos. So you still have these late migrants kind of coming through. And we have yet to hit peak weird duck season, Larry. So I'm really excited about that. The waterfowl are going to be coming through here. I've seen a couple reports of snowy owls already in the state. So you have birds on the move. My feeders with American goldfinches have been very busy lately. So they're keeping themselves busy out there right now. So there's still birds on the move in this late fall season.
Dexter Patterson, our guest today, author of Birds of the Great Lakes. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. If you have birdhouses or bird baths, important to keep them clean.
100%. I try to tell people to clean them at least every 2 weeks. and using kind of like a bleach solution, 9 parts water, 1 part bleach, really easy, effective. And I do that all the time, just kind of bake it into your habit. And this time of year, as we go into winter, those, especially the fresh water sources, heated bird baths are really, really helpful for the birds, as well as, you know, a nice food source as the food becomes more scarce for them. So if you want to see potentially some red poles come to your yard, and, you know, the little chickadees, you might even have some American goldfinches that are hanging around. The water feature can bring in American robins that are sticking around as well. So it is really kind of helpful. And then you can have birds hanging out in your yard if you're blessed or lucky enough to have one, all, you know, throughout the winter.
You know, one of the things that I enjoy about your book is the, as you look at it, one, you have kind of little, one little section that talks about little facts.
Mm-hmm.
About the birds. And one that I literally opened the book up and I hit the blue jay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I had ever read this. The blue jay feathers are actually brown.
Yes.
Because of the melanin, which is a dark pigment. But they... there's an optical effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the blue light that you see, the blue UV light, kind of has this reaction with these crystals in the feather, and that's what we allow. That's what allows us to see the blue in the actual feather. It's kind of cool. So if you happen to be hiking and you see a blue jay feather on the ground, you can actually pick it up and turn away from the sun and block it from that UV, from those blue lights, and you can see the change in the feather, which is really kind of cool to see it in. So if you happen to be out hiking and you see a blue jay feather, they're pretty busy right now storing food for the winter. So good chance you might be able to find one out there one of these times. Pick it up and hide it from the sun and kind of see that reaction in front of you. It's kind of mind-blowing.
It is indeed, and I've got some more little surprises that we can talk about as we go along. But I wanted you to mention your birding club of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the club.
Yeah, so I'm the co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. So if anybody doesn't know what that acronym stands for, it's Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. And I created this birding club because I wanted to grow the birding community. You know, as I was getting into birding and going out to a lot of these traditional events, I was often the only person of color there. And for me, I just felt like, man, birds are way too cool for this giant segment of people not to know that birding is for them. So I wanted to create a space where everybody, where Black, brown, everybody in between could come out, enjoy birds together. And I get this question asked all the time. Hey, I'm a white person. Can I come to your club? And I say, you can come. It's as simple as, do you want to see the birding community be more welcoming in our state? Do you want to see it more inclusive? Do you want to see it more diverse? Yes. If the answer to those questions is yes, you are welcome at our events. And that's what you see, Larry. You see people of all walks of life at our events every month, and really, really kind of showing people that birding is for everyone, and doing my part in our beautiful state to grow the birding community.
And I should mention that your website, which I really knew would be really good.
Thank you.
Given your own skills, it's BIPOC.org? Is that what it is? I forgot now.
Yeah, BIPOCBirdingClub.org.
BIPOC, B-I-P-O-C. No, BIPOC.
B-I-P-O-C, birdingclub.org.
Dexter Patterson, our guest, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today as we talk with him about birds and birding. And if you have some birding questions or bird questions, I hope you'll join in. He knows a lot. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back with Dexter. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News, talking today with the author of the book, Birds of the Great Lakes, How They Look and Sound, Where to Find Them, and How to Protect Them. Dexter Patterson, our guest. Dexter is an educator, multimedia professional, co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about your favorite bird or maybe a rare sighting you're proud of or just a question. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Richard in Beloit called and said he would like to hear about binoculars for bird watchers. What do you recommend for binoculars?
You know, I always tell people, start with what's in your budget, right? So don't think that you need to go out and spend hundreds and hundreds. Some people spend thousands of dollars on binoculars, and that is not necessary. I would also say take advantage of local resources. So the Feminist Bird Club of Madison has a birding backpack program, for example, in the Madison Public Library, where you can check out a backpack. It has field guides in it and binoculars in it. Many of the birding clubs that you can go to, including ours or the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, they have binoculars that you can borrow as well for all of the events. So I would say before you get started, maybe try some out. And see what's working for you. Do you want an 8x32? Do you want an 8x42? Do you want a 10x32? Do you want a 10x42, right? You have all these different options for you, but binoculars are super helpful to get you closer into the environment, get you closer to the bird, and allow you to see the bird from a safe distance where you're not bothering them and you're actually getting to see some more details of the actual bird. So the first thing I always tell people before they consider binoculars is try some out. You can even go into some of these stores and try them out and, you know, find something within your budget. If it's a $50 pair of binoculars, so be it. They will work fine until you feel like you need another pair. So don't put that pressure on yourself thinking you need to have the best of the best of the best. It's just a tool. And I tell people all the time, you don't need the fancy equipment to go birding. Do whatever is in your budget.
And if you have the opportunity, I think it's a good idea to take a hold of those binoculars and then hold them up to your eyes and hold them there for a minute or so. Sometimes I've had some heavier ones that are sometimes a little difficult to hold for long periods of time, but that's just me. Maybe somebody else would have a different thought on it.
Yeah, and I always say, too, it's real easy to get lost in binoculars
yeah.
for folks that are yeah. just kind of starting out with them. So I always tell people, you know, before we get started at our bird events, I always ask, does anybody need binoculars? I hand them out. I'm always asking, are there any new birders? And typically every event, there's a couple new birders that are joining us. And I'll do a quick binocular tutorial with them, show them how to adjust the eyepieces, and really kind of let them know, all right, I'll pick a sign or something really easy for them to like try to focus on in their binoculars first. And I'll teach them how to get whatever we're looking at, that landmark in focus, and teach them how to do that. And then I'll really start to stress the fact of, if we're looking at birds and you're trying to get your binocular on the birds, is look at the bird first. Look at what you're looking at first, and then put the binoculars up, because if you're trying to find them in the trees with you're going to be all over the place. You know, it's not going to end up well for you.
Bob in Waupaca, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. And I just want to let your listeners know that there is a newer wildlife refuge that's opened up to the public actually last May of last year. It's in the city of Wapaka and the town of Wapaka. It's approximately 300 acres, and if you go to the website, woodpilewildliferefuge.com, the first thing that'll pop up is a site that'll take you to eBird, and if you scroll through there, you'll see the people that have been reporting since last year, the sightings that they've had, and I think they're up to about 170 different species of birds that have been seen out there. So it's in the city of Wapaka, the map and location is on the website, and it's been open to the public since last May of last year. It's about 300 acres, and it consists of there's some primarily wetlands, but there is an upland, heavily forested 50-acre parcel that has a change in topography. That 50 acres of about 100 feet, so it's got some real dramatic scenery topography there. So I just wanted to
pretty cool. Yeah, pretty cool. Bob, thanks. Have you been there yet, Dexter?
Hey, I will. I want to give a big shout out to Wapaka, actually, and my bird banding mentor, Bob Welch. He passed away not a little less than 2 years ago. He lived in Wapaka, and so shout out to Bob, calling from Wapaka. One of my dearest and biggest birding mentors was from Wapaka, and I did bird banding up there for years with him. This time of year, we'd be banding northern saw-whet owls in Wapaka, so I have a lot of really, really special memories in that community. So.
Oh, Bob, thanks a lot for calling and letting us know. Sherry in Clinton, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I was recently in Door County, and we took the ferry over to Washington Island. And where you catch the ferry, there on the breakwater were some really big dark brown birds with maybe kind of tan chests. And I didn't have a bird book handy, and I didn't think about it for a while. And when I got to my bird book, the only thing that looked kind of close to it was maybe a cormorant. Would that be a possibility?
Yeah, double crested cormorants be a really good possibility. Maybe some younger birds there for sure.
Yeah, I think you got cormorants there, Sherry. Thanks for calling. Rick in Juneau, Alaska, what's on your mind?
Well, hello there. I was telling earlier, I am a child of the 60s in southeast Wisconsin, and I've been gone for over 40 years now. And you know, living up here in Juneau, Alaska, I see a lot of birds that are not there in southeast Wisconsin. But having recently retired, I was in my childhood home for September and October, and I was amazed to see the number of wild turkeys running around in my yard. And also stunned that the bald eagles have returned to southeast Alaska. Now, up here, if you want to see a bald eagle, you just tell the tourists, oh, go to the dump, because there's hundreds of them. But seeing them in southeast Wisconsin has been a wonderful thing to see again after so many years. And I'm looking forward to my permanent move back down to southeast Wisconsin, that is, in retirement, and continuing a tradition that my mother instilled upon me, which is to attract as many different types of birds as possible to our yard, including red-headed woodpeckers that live in the snags that we don't cut down to the ground. We cut them off about 20 feet above.
Oh, you're breaking up there, Rick. Comment, Dexter?
I love that he said he does not cut down the snags. Those are homes. Those are habitats for not only woodpeckers, but nuthatches and chimney swifts and all these incredible birds whose homes are being taken away. So I know a lot of times people might view them as eyesores, but You never know. You might have an eastern screech owl in your yard or something. So keep them up. And I love that he talked about the bald eagle and the return of the bald eagle. Fantastic conservation story, along with the sandhill crane. When I think about the state of Wisconsin, I always tell people I love the American robin, but I would love to see the sandhill crane be the state bird of Wisconsin. It is so majestic when you think about, you just had Stanley on and you're thinking about Aldo Leopold and, you know, him talking about land ethic and mentioning how we basically didn't deserve those birds because we almost wiped them out. And now it's one of the best conservation stories when you think about birds in the country. And it started right here in our state. So I love that call.
Yeah, I do too. And speaking of woodpeckers, I was looking in your book, and I noticed the pileated, which you point out is the largest remaining woodpecker in North America. Of course, the ivory-billed woodpecker would have been a little bigger, but it has been extirpated.
Yeah. And I think you appreciate this, Larry. That bird, that photo of that pileated woodpecker is right over at Picnic Point. That's where I got that shot.
Well, that is pretty nice. I can mention that I have, there's a famous bird wood carver who carved both the ivory-billed and the pileated, and I have both of those sitting on my, it's sitting somewhere in the house. I've got decoys and bird wood carvings all over the place, but it's pretty fun to have those. Jeremy in Mineral Point, your turn. Hi, Jeremy.
What's going on, y'all? What's going on, Dexter? I just wanted to call and send some positive affirmation. I'm a black male living in Mineral Point, the city. I've watched the work you have done over the years, and I just want you to know the ripple and the impact that you're making is tremendous, and it's really timely, and it's been helping me and my community navigate the tricky time. So thank you so much, brother, for all that you do. We appreciate you. We see you, and we hope to continue to elevate this movement because it's something so important for the times right now.
Bless you so much, Jeremy. That gave me chills. Like, you literally just made my day. And I always say that, like, birds bring people together. Like, I encourage people, go to my website, go to my social media, go to WiscoBirder.com, go to @WiscoBirder on Instagram, and look at what I bring out at events. Like, the diversity, old, young, it doesn't matter, every shape, every color. I always tell people the birding community should reflect the birds we all love. Birds come in all different colors. They come in all different shapes and sizes. Some are fast, some are slow. Heck, some of them can't even fly, right? And I think about people, and I think about us as a community. Birds are such a great way to bring people together, and I especially want folks like Jeremy and black and brown folks out here in Wisconsin to understand that nature is for you. I create these spaces for people to feel safe. Some people be like, I can't go out there by myself. I don't feel safe. But you can be safe with us, 20, 30, sometimes 40 plus people together in the woods, having a good time, finding community with one another. So, Jeremy, thank you so much. I'm going to have to get out to Mineral Point and lead a walk so I can meet you in person because you just made my day.
And that BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin, you guys do a lot of events.
Yes. Yeah, we do. We host monthly events, at least two in the Madison and Milwaukee area. But we also, some months we may have specialty events. Like, I'm on book tour right now, so I've been traversing this state and going up to communities all over the state. But some months, like December, we do Christmas bird count. We do citizen science. We do bird banding. We do eagle nest box monitoring. We'll do kestrel nest box monitoring. We'll do different things like that. So there are some months, or it's Black Birders Week, we'll do multiple events in a month. So maybe it's two or three events, but you at least get two opportunities to get outside with our birding club every single month, 12 months a year. Yes, we bird in the winter, folks. People ask me that all the time. I'm like, yes, we bird all year year round. The birds are still here. Some leave and new ones show up. So we always got something going on, and people always like, oh, I missed this one or I missed that one. And I'm like, don't worry about it. We will be here for you when you can make it. All right. So don't worry about it. We'll always have opportunities for you and welcome you with open arms when you're able to make it.
Stephen Dresser called but couldn't stay with us. Had a question about cedar wax wings. Stephen says they fly in groups, but do they also nest in groups? Cedar wax.
They don't nest in groups. You know, everybody's gonna. They may nest in certain habitat areas together, but they have their own nest. They maintain their own nest. What I love about the cedar waxwings, especially in Wisconsin, as the weather is getting colder, you're going to start to see them on the berry trees. You're going to start seeing them on the junipers. You're going to see them eating crab apples and all these different berry trees. And they're very like mindful of preserving these food resources for themselves. They'll feed on other things when it's warm, and they really save these berries for the colder months, which is really beautiful when you can see a group of them just show up on a crabapple tree and there's snow on it. It's just beautiful.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about all the interesting things that I've read in your book, and when nesting came to mind, and you have a really cool little story about Virginia rails.
Mm.
They've developed kind of an ingenious survival technique with their nests. They create floating nests in the dense marshland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you think about it, there's other birds, like sandhill cranes will build in the middle of a marsh and in the water. That works sometimes it doesn't, but this helps keep their nest more hidden in these dense marshes, and so it is it's really cool. And they'll even create decoy nests too. So
rails will, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they do a lot of really cool things to try to maximize the survival of their young. So it is really, really kind of fascinating.
And one other that, there were a lot of others, but green herons.
that one always gets people.
they'll drop insects in the water or maybe a little piece of feather or a little piece of wood or something.
Yeah, they'll chum the water and they're literally just like fishing and trying to bring in things, and they'll throw it out in the water. They'll pick it back up. Like, it is fascinating when you watch it. Like, birds are, they're so freaking smart. They're so cool. And that's why I said about it being windows to wonder. Like, you see this bird and then like you realize it's nothing like that other one. So many people, especially new birders, they just think every bird was just a robin or every bird is just a bird, right? And then they start to find out that there's so many different ones and there's so many different ones around them, and it kind of blows their mind. And when you start to learn about them, little fun facts about that is it's kind of mind blowing. I said, like, the more I learn about birds, they kind of turn me into the emoji on your phone where your head's blowing up. You know, I tell people that because, like, every time I learn something new and I'm just like, wow, like, they are fascinating. They're so cool.
Clara Neipert, who is the producer for the show, was telling me as she looked through the book, she really found it interesting that hummingbirds are the second most diverse bird family on Earth.
Yeah, and a lot, especially us here, like the main one we're going to get is the ruby-throated hummingbird. We might get a vagrant Allen's or, you know, some random, you know, West Coast hummingbird will show up. But when you get to the West Coast, when you go down in the Arizona area, along the border of Mexico, there are so many species of hummingbirds in that area, South America. So I think that the fact that we typically only see one, we just don't think about how many hummingbirds there are out there, how many different hummingbird species.
Well, your book, Birds of the Great Lakes, would be a handy one to take along because it, what is it, 5x6, something like that, the size
of
it?
Yeah, it's pretty small. Like I said, you can hold it in your hand. I got a pretty big hand, so it almost fills up my hand, but it fits in your pocket. It'll fit in a pouch of a hoodie. And, you know, so it is very, very accessible and something you can kind of keep with you. Don't need a huge backpack or anything.
Bruce and Baraboo, it's your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, Larry.
What's on your mind?
Well, a couple weeks ago, I was in northern Wisconsin on the shore of a lake, and it was a calm day, and it was a sunny day, and there was a hatch of midges out over the lake, and I watched red-breasted nuthatches, which are a stubby little bird, fly out and feed on this midge hatch swarming over the lake. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the bird-insect connection.
That's their favorite food, most of them, a lot of them, right? That's where they're getting their protein if they're not just strictly seed eaters. Nut hatches are fascinating. The red-breasted nut hatches are fascinating. They're tiny little things too. It's kind of cool. I do bird banding, and we had one of each. And the white-breasted nut hatch is trying to bully the red-breasted nut hatch. But they can actually, you can hold them and you can turn them and they'll hang upside down. Seeing them actually fly out into a swarm of birds is very unique because they're typically going up and down the tree trunks and really kind of foraging in evergreens and things like that, especially this time of year. So that's definitely some different behavior that I don't typically see, but that's their favorite food for most birds. And I'm not going to put them all in there, but that's where they get their protein.
And you mentioned robins in passing there, and robins are interesting to me because they will hang around, some of them at least, in winter here in Wisconsin. I always have one or two in my neighborhood, mm-hmm. But they completely change their diet.
Yeah. Yeah, all of a sudden they'll start eating different things. They'll like pop up at your feeder and you're like, what's going on? I have an American robin and a bird feeder. What I find is the water feature also brings them in throughout the winter, and then they'll explore. And next thing you'll see them in crabapple trees and different things. So I think it's cool. They definitely shift their focus from their worms because the ground is frozen. They can't get to them. So,
well, Bird Joy, you are a guy, I think, that are a person who spreads bird joy. You talk about bird joy. What's the experience like for you spreading that bird joy?
You know, that is kind of my mission. My mission is to spread as much bird joy as possible across the state. Because birds change my life, you know, and they bring me a lot of joy. And I want to spread that to as many people as possible. I also have seen, you know, in my time with birding is that over time, people that have been birding for a long time, they start to lose their joy, Larry. And I want to encourage people not to do that, not to get so fixated on adding another bird to their list. And now you're not paying attention to the 40 other birds you saw that day because you're chasing just this one bird. And I see this over and over and over with seasoned birders and people that are just trying to add that next bird to their list. They're running to Superior to go see a varied thrush and they don't get it. And then they're all upset. But you saw snow yowl, or you saw this, you saw that, and they don't even care anymore. So it's kind of sad. Bird joy is about appreciating every bird. When I'm out in the field, I tell my members that are there, bird every bird, appreciate every bird. We're not promised to see them, right? They're not promised to be here forever. We lost a passenger pigeon with what the largest populated bird in our country. We wiped it out. We almost wiped out the sandhill crane. So I always tell people, appreciate all the birds. There's something different to see. Spend time with at least just one bird and notice the little differences on it. They're all different, right? Every season is different behaviors. There's always something different to pay attention to. So that's bird joy, is really kind of being in the moment, constantly appreciating every single bird that you are lucky enough to spend some time with, and never losing sight of how happy they used to make you and how happy they do make you.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dexter, you've written a great little book here, Birds of the Great Lakes, How They Look and Sound, Where to Find Them, How to Protect Them. Best little book of birds, Birds of the Great Lakes. Dexter, it's been a real pleasure. talking with you today. I hope we have a chance to do this again. Will you come back and be with us again?
Larry, if you need me, I'm there. You know, we go back, you know, life sciences, communications. The whole staff told me to tell you hi. We miss you. We appreciate you. So if you need me, you got me.
Dexter, thank you so much. Dexter Patterson, you can go online and take a look at his organization, the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. And, man, take a look at his book, Birds of the Great Lakes, How They Look and Sound, Where to Find Them, and How to Protect Them. That is the subtitle. Well, there's a lot of birds at Horicon Marsh, and we're going to find out next what's going on at Horicon Marsh with the birds. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Every year, hundreds of thousands of birds pass through the Horicon Marsh. Man, I tell you, we are so lucky in this state to have the Horicon Marsh. It's stated as a wetland of international importance. And I tell you what, we're going to get an update on the Horicon Marsh and maybe talk a little bit about migration at Horicon Marsh. And maybe hear more about the Horicon Marsh Bird Club from our guest, Liz Herman. She is the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh. And as we talk with Liz, I hope you'll join in. Tell us why you love being a part of maybe your own local bird club. Maybe you have a question about the birds at Horicon Marsh. Have you spent time watching birds at the marsh before? I've been there many, many times to look at the birds, and I've always enjoyed it. Give us a call, though, with your own comments and experiences. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Liz Herzman, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I tell you what, Horicon Marsh, a migration hub for birds. How many birds pass through the marsh?
I mean, I think the easy answer is a lot, right? Like, it's really, really tough to put a number on that. And it is truly just a huge number of birds in general. I know a lot of people have amazing memories of large amounts of Canada geese coming through the marsh, but we really have huge numbers of ducks, of geese, of sandhill cranes. So the variety coming through in the fall is just truly phenomenal. And it's really amazing because every time you go out there, you're guaranteed to see something different, which is what I love about it.
And I think there's something like reported maybe 300 or more species of birds that have been identified as coming through the marsh. What makes the marsh a good stopover?
Sure. So Horicon Marsh is a 33,000 acre wetland. So it's a massive wetland complex that we have here in the state of Wisconsin. There's really nothing else like it. And having that amount of space means you're going to have tons of critical habitat for those birds that are coming through. So they're going to have the food, the water, the shelter, the space that they need. And so many of these birds passing through on migration are not just staying for short bursts of time, but maybe a little bit longer as they refuel for whatever their next step in the migration is. Whereas other places, if they only have small space, little bits of food, it might just be a quick see it really fast, and then they're moving on to the next location. But Horicon, the beauty of that is there is so much habitat for them that they tend to stick around a little bit longer, which it gives us the beautiful opportunity to see them for a little bit longer. If you don't get a chance to come one day at Horicon, the next day, there's going to be birds there too, probably.
Which species can you see like right now or this time of the year, the next month or so?
Sure. So into November, we still certainly have waterfowl that are coming through. And we typically say at Horicon, peak migration for waterfowl is anywhere between mid-October and mid-November. And the reason for such a large breadth of time there is it's really dependent on a lot of weather patterns and what the temperatures are like in Canada or our northern counties, because those cold fronts and north winds are what are moving birds in. And so we're really watching for those. And so right now we've got a lot of our ducks that are out, some of our early ones like blue wing teal and wood ducks, but we're seeing some of our diving ducks move in, hopefully more of our ringneck ducks, maybe some canvasback redhead. We are seeing our first reports of some small flocks of tundra swans that are moving through. And of course, our sandhill cranes are certainly staging in the area right now as well. So there's really good opportunity to see birds for the next couple of weeks until the marsh freezes over. And once we get ice on the marsh, a lot less habitat for the birds to use. And so that's one of the triggers to get them to, you know, move on a little bit further where there's open water, a bit more food to get to.
Marty in Chippewa Falls has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Marty.
Hey, Larry. We're really interested in your program today. My husband and I are doing our own little migration from Crex Meadows, a bit further north of you, down to Nisida, and that's where we know our sandhills migrate. My particular interest, and Gary's, is that we've written a children's book about two sandhill cranes who adopted a Canada goose and actually did this migration and came back. And we know that you have many of your listeners right now who are following a similar story in Madison, near Madison, and are wondering, will that goose that we've come to love so much, will they be able to migrate back? And we're here to say, yes, they can. Only five times has this ever happened. So, and it's never happened that they've migrated. So exciting stories, huh?
They are. Liz Erzman, a comment.
Yeah, those are great stories. And actually, I think the folks that are from Madison that are sharing that story that's currently going on, we're actually at Horicon either last week or the week before, and they were sharing that exact story with me, which was so exciting and so unique and so interesting. And they were showing me tons of pictures of the sandhill crane colt with the goose. And it's such an unlikely pair, but they seem to be doing just fine. And we're excited to see them migrate. And hopefully next spring we'll be hearing or seeing some photos of the two of them back again.
That's great. Marty, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Tell me about the Horicon Marsh Bird Club. We heard about the BIPOC Bird Club of Madison with Dexter Patterson. It's a great, doing some wonderful work here in the Madison and Milwaukee areas, actually, as well. But what about the Horicon Marsh Bird Club?
Yeah, it's a really great club. And actually, Dexter was out with his club this past weekend, so it was nice to be able to see him as well and many of his club members. But we also have a birding club. There are many throughout the state of Wisconsin, so definitely check your local areas to see what club is your best fit. But here at Horicon, we have the Horicon Marsh Bird Club. We do a lot of different trips around the Dodge County area, not just Horicon, because there are other little sweet spots in the county as well that we love to go and bird. And it's a great organization. We do monthly meetings every third Thursday at 6:30 p.m. Here at the education center that I work at for the DNR. And the general public is certainly welcome. You do not have to be a club member to come to those meetings. And we have a great lineup of speakers coming up, anything from kestrels to purple martins to folks from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, some folks from UW-Madison talking about flying wildlife and wind energy and those impacts. And then we also do a number of field trips throughout the year, just as Dexter's does as well. And so we really are a group that loves to welcome all birders in, just like many others. And we love to showcase Horicon Marsh because it is just one of those iconic places to come out and see birds. And our bird club also sponsors a number of big events throughout the year.
Well, and what a setting. That education center. Describe that education center. What a beautiful setting.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the gems of education centers across the state. I'm a little biased because obviously I run it, but it's definitely amazing. We're located on the southeast corner of Horicon Marsh between the towns of Horicon and Mayville, and we have a large education center and facility that we can use for public programming, for school groups that are coming through, for bird club events, for hikes, as we've got about 5 miles of trails that connect to our education center. We have really amazing exhibits called the Explorium that are all hands-on interactive exhibits that go through the story of the marsh from glaciation all the way to present-day management. And so if you haven't had a chance to come visit our center, we'd love to see you. You will be welcomed by a massive, giant woolly mammoth made of rebar. So if you don't see that coming into the education center, you're at the wrong place. But it's a super cool opportunity, and we'd love to see you out for all sorts of different events and programs and things that we do.
Stan Tebble was earlier on the show and talking about that woolly mammoth and how he's observed kids when they get out of the car and their eyes get really big and their mouth gets really wide open and they're amazed at the thought of something that large actually being hunted back in the day when people didn't have rifles.
Absolutely. It's a beacon. Everybody is drawn to it as soon as they get to the marsh. I can't even tell you how many photos have probably been snapped in front of that guy. So it was a really awesome piece to have to welcome folks.
Oh, man. Liz Herzman, our guest of the Wisconsin DNR. She is the wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mehler for WPR News. Talking about Horicon Marsh and the birds of Horicon Marsh with our guest today, Liz Herzman, who is the DNR wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh. Again, questions for her, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Steve had called to ask you to mention the hours of the visitor center, which are important for sure.
Yes, absolutely. I'm happy to do so. So we are open currently weekdays 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And for just another week, both Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. But we will be going, we won't be doing Sundays coming up during our winter hours. But then once kind of March rolls around, we'll be hitting 7 days a week again. And our hiking trails are open regardless of if our facility is open. So hopefully you can still get out and do some walking, do some strolling, do some birding while you're out there as well.
Yeah, those hiking trails are great. I love trekking around on those trails for sure. We have, it's a long ways off and we'll probably get you back and talk about it later. But in May, every May, you hold a Horicon Marsh Bird Festival, which
we
is
do.
Really cool. Talk about that for a sec.
Yeah, it's a wonderful partnership. The marsh is huge, right? It's 33,000 acres. And so we have DNR that owns the southern one-third, Fish and Wildlife Service that owns the northern two-thirds. Then there is a private nature center on the north end of the marsh called Marsh Haven Nature Center. And then there is also a boat tour that operates in the town of Horicon. And so Horicon Marsh Bird Festival is this great opportunity to meld all of these partnerships and be able to host a 3 to 4 day festival where we're just celebrating birds, right? And we are celebrating anybody that wants to come out and see birds, whether you are 2 years old or 99 plus years old. Everybody is welcome. And we have events and activities that basically caters to all birders. And it's always Mother's Day weekend. So this year it'll be that May 8th through the 10th. You can always just write that on your calendar. You know, Horicon Marsh Bird Festival is Mother's Day weekend. We are the oldest bird festival in the state of Wisconsin. So we've been doing this a long time. And again, we have different events. There are boat tours, there are hikes, there are walking tours, there are bus tours, there are speakers on different topics of birds. There is so much that I really challenge you to find something that doesn't fit your birding skill. And if you do, then let me know and we'd be happy to work on getting something else out there for you as well. But we love to welcome all birders and all skills and all sets and just celebrate spring migration and what's out there for us.
You know, I've, for some stupid reason, I've never done the boat tour.
You should. They do a really nice job.
I mean, what do they do? Well, they go ahead.
I was going to say, it's a nice, smooth, comfortable pontoon boat ride. Goes up main ditch of Horicon Marsh, narrated, and then you also get some free time to just kind of enjoy being out there. And it's a wonderful opportunity. I would highly recommend it.
So another opportunity is that Nest Box seminar.
Yes.
What are a few things to know about birdhouses? What can you learn at this talk?
I think the simplest thing is that there are the right ways and there are the wrong ways to put up birdhouses and bird boxes. And our goal for this particular seminar is to give best management practices for putting nesting boxes on your property. Because a box is not just a box for any bird. There are certain species that prefer certain size boxes, certain holes, certain placement of where they are so that predators are not getting into those boxes. And so we just want to make sure that if people are truly passionate about grabbing and getting cavity nesting birds on their property, they are doing it in the best way possible, not only for the birds, but also for the maintenance and the management and the monitoring of those birds. Because, you don't just put a box up and just say, all right, done. It's good. Birds are going to come. It's going to be great. No problem. There is a lot of work in it as well, where you're constantly monitoring, making sure the right birds are coming in. We don't have invasive species entering in those boxes. And so our goal is just to make sure people are getting those boxes up the proper way, so it is the most beneficial for the birds that need them.
As you were talking, I was thinking about bluebird houses. And if they're the wrong size hole, for example, to get into the, somebody said, well, that's like they become a feeder for owls. A perfect feeder for owls if you got the wrong
size. Absolutely. Or other predators of sorts. So yes, those little details can make a difference on if you get bluebirds or tree swallows or purple martins or wood ducks or whatever it is that you're trying to attract to your property. And so we're hopefully trying to give you the best information possible to do that.
So the holiday season's fast approaching. Yesterday, I shot a little video at a Christmas tree farm that'll be coming up and online at some point. But gifts for birders. What's the first thing? What do you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many options out there. And I think one of the big things is to know your person, right? Know your birder. Are they just getting into this? Are they a few years advanced? Are they, 20, 30 years into birding? Because there are so many different options out there. One of the things, I know you and Dexter chatted a little bit about binoculars, and I feel like that's a super personal gift and almost one that the person should pick. However, there is one binocular accessory that I would highly recommend for all birders, and that's a binocular strap. It's like a harness, basically. And so if you are intending to spend a lot of time with binoculars around your neck, this harness can make it so much nicer that you don't have that strain and that stress of the strap on your neck. And, like for me, I live in my binoculars for many months of the year. And so having that harness saves me probably quite a bit of money on chiropractor visits because it's really handy to have. And it just makes it so much more fluid to get those binoculars up to your eyes. And they're pretty inexpensive and just a nice little gift for folks that tend to use their binoculars a lot or have future plans to use them a lot.
I like that idea. What do they look like? They're a harness, huh?
They're essentially a harness. It's just straps that you put your arms through and binoculars sit on your chest then, and then you can just pull them right up. And it basically just takes all of the pressure off of your neck and puts that all throughout your back and your shoulders. And it's like, you're not even wearing them. It's wonderful.
There are some high-tech bird feeders, high-tech baths, bird baths out there, and the houses that I've seen on Facebook, I'm getting ad after ad about cameras that will fit inside the birdhouse, and they show some amazing photos. Have you had any experience with any or all of that?
Yeah, I've heard about them. So they're these smart bird feeders, basically, where they have cameras in there, and then essentially they run the pictures through some sort of AI, and they can identify the bird. You can get it set up so every time a bird comes to your feeder, your phone gets an alert, almost like a Ring camera for your bird feeder, right? Like, I mean, it's essentially what it is. And so you get these alerts, and it says, hey, a northern cardinal is at your feeder currently, and you can either pop in and look, or if you're already sitting at your feeder, it gives you a chance to help identify those birds. So I don't have one yet. I'm kind of curious about them, but I've heard of a number of people that have them and enjoy them, and gives them a little something extra out of their bird feeding experience. So those seem to be a bit newer on the market, and I'm excited to see where those go.
Tim emailed to ask if you can take a canoe into the marsh and maybe fish.
Sure. So you can take a canoe or a kayak into portions of the marsh. So the northern two-thirds of Horicon Marsh is National Wildlife Refuge. There is no paddling, no boating whatsoever, because it's protected as a refuge. The southern one-third of the marsh is the state wildlife area. You can canoe, you can kayak, you can paddle in areas there. We actually have some recommended routes if you want to. As far as fishing goes, fishing is okay if you like fishing for like carp and bullhead and more rough fish. I wouldn't say it's a destination necessarily for larger game fish, although there are a few secret pockets in some areas of the marsh or along some of the branches of the Rock River that flow into the marsh. But it's a beautiful way to get out and explore Horicon Marsh in a boat and really just get intimate with some of the interior of the marsh and see some things you wouldn't see from necessarily the hiking trails or even the driving tours around it.
John in Madison wants to know about birdseed. What birdseed do you recommend for this time of the year?
Right. We could do a whole program just on bird feeding and bird seed. So what I always recommend is if you only had one choice in bird seed, I would choose a straight black oil sunflower seed. It's going to give them the most protein. It also potentially has the most diversity of birds feeding on that. Everything from cardinals to finches to nuthatches to woodpeckers, chickadees. They're all going to be feeding on that black oil sunflower seed. You can get those mixes at a little bit less expensive, but sometimes those mixes just have a lot of filler in it, like millet and cracked corn, which isn't a heavy food source for a lot of birds. And so I like to say get that straight black oil sunflower seed. You can also feed thistle or niger seed at this point in time. You just need a little sock feeder, because that's for birds that have smaller beaks, like more of our finches or pine siskins if they start coming into the area. Winter is a good time for suet cakes, because they're less messy than in the winter or in the summer. Those they can get pretty gooey when the temperatures are a bit warmer. So at our house, we tend to stick to suet cakes in the colder months when it's much easier to take out and clean and get to. But those are definitely some recommendations currently. And you can add to that a little bit. I know they have a number of like heated bird baths on the market. So even in cold temperatures, you can offer that food and that water combination, which is just critical for a lot of our birds.
Are there still threats to the marsh? I mean, it's a national preserve and everything like that, but are there some threats?
I mean, I think there's threats to everything out there in nature, unfortunately, at this point in time. One of the things that we constantly battle are invasive species that are creeping into different areas of the marsh, not only in the woodland surrounding, but also the upland surrounding, with things like wild parsnip and buckthorn and garlic mustard. It's kind of weird to think about, because Horicon Marsh is known as the largest freshwater cattail marsh in the contiguous United States. But we spend a lot of our job fighting cattails, because we have a very aggressive version of cattails that's hybridized, and it's not great for wildlife. And so we're fighting one of the things that makes us the most famous, which is kind of ironic in itself. But certainly, definitely issues it, and we are always working on new adaptive management strategies to work with those and try to provide the best habitat for the wildlife, so it then provides the best opportunities for people to get out and enjoy the wildlife that's there.
One last question. Is it true that Canada geese can actually fly up to 1,200 miles in a single day?
They can fly if they get the right weather patterns and weather conditions, with, you know, a good cold front, a very strong north wind, they can go a long ways, most certainly. And that is possible.
And some of them are on the move right now. Liz,
they are.
Liz, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Love talking with you.
I'd love to be back. Thanks for having me.
Liz Herzman is the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh. What a fun day we had today talking with Liz and Dexter. It's been, of course, talking about the calendar with our guest as well. It's always fun, and it's always fun to work in a team like I've got. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer and kind of our boss, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.